today on Against the Grain. What is this thing called police? What do the police exist to do, really? And what does Mark Neoklios mean by a critical theory of police power? I'm CS. We'll re-present a conversation with the British theorist about police power, the war power, vagrancy legislation, and the exigencies of capital coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Demands for reforms to police departments and to police as an institution have proliferated in recent years. There must be more accountability, transparency, and respect for civil liberties. Police agencies must be restructured. The militarization of the police must stop. Letters are written, rallies are held, signs are carried, statements are made at hearings and assemblies. But what if, as today's guest contends, what if all of those demands are off the mark? What if they all miss the point of what the police power actually is and what it exists to do? A critical theory of police power is what Mark Neoklios has developed and advanced in books, in articles, and in an issue of the journal Social Justice that he and the Anti-Security Collective have edited. To that issue, he contributed an essay with the title Original, Absolute, Indefeasible, or What We Talk About When We Talk About Police Power. Mark Neoklios is professor of the Critique of Political Economy at Brunel University, London, and the author of many books, including A Critical Theory of Police Power, The Fabrication of the Social Order, and The Universal Adversary, Security, Capital, and, quote, the Enemies of All Mankind. When Mark and I connected recently, I asked why he began his essay by noting how popular the use of tear gas by police forces against citizens, protesters, and others has become.
I chose it because I thought it had a certain kind of impact. Tear gas is quite dramatic. Most people haven't been on the receiving end of tear gas, but they've seen images of police using tear gas, and those images are quite stark. And if you have been on the receiving end of tear gas, you'll know how just truly horrible it is. And so it's a very very stark example of very direct police brutality, violence, aggression, and also a very, you know, technological form of police aggression. You know, it's very different to the bat on the head, the nightstick on the head. And so I wanted to use that partly because of its starkness. I also wanted to use it because I wanted to frame the argument by pointing to the extent of its use by police forces in all sorts of contexts. And then I guess the main issue was that I wanted to use it in order to enact a kind of rhetorical ploy, which was to say, look, there is a way that the use of tear gas by police forces has been understood and discussed and criticised by radicals, by activists, by scholars, which is to talk about the militarization of policing or paramilitary policing. And I think that way of approaching policing is problematic. It takes us in the wrong direction. It's almost a distraction. And so I wanted to use tear gas as a way of saying, well, one way of thinking about tear gas, the use of tear gas by police forces is, you know, this is police militarization. But maybe that's not the way we should be thinking about policing. Maybe that's not the way we should be approaching the whole question of police power.
So what is wrong or misguided about the argument that the police is getting militarized? It is getting more militarized, suggesting, as you read in your article, that police in the past were not, in fact, military in style and in form.
Right. Well, there's a number of difficulties that approach to policing creates. I mean, the first is, I think, just straightforwardly, it misrepresents the whole history of policing. It kind of presupposes that somehow policing and warfare and militarized activity were somehow fundamentally different, and that the use of certain kinds of technologies, such as tear gas, is bringing them together. And I think that's just historically just false. If you look at the institutional history of police forces, they were deeply embedded with military forces. And indeed, in some countries, you know, there are particular forms of institution which straddle both police and military. So I think partly the problem is just to try and debunk the kind of the myth of the history of police forces, which goes, you know, they're not about war, they're not about the military, they're about something else. So that's the first thing. The second thing is to then try and get people to recognise that police forces themselves, police institutions themselves, the police power itself, when it thinks about itself and when it talks about itself, it talks about itself in terms of war, in terms of constantly fighting wars. You know, the war on crime being the most obvious, but also the war on disorder, the war on drugs, the war on poverty, and so forth. And I think we need to take that language seriously. You know, I think we need to understand, to recognise that when police personnel, when police theorists talk about fighting wars, they mean it seriously, right? And they don't mean this metaphorically. This is not a metaphor that they're using. They mean it very, very seriously.
Yeah, let me ask you about a couple examples in your piece. One is the police forces in Ferguson, Missouri. We know something. You tell us something about how they perceive the people who protested the 2014 police killing of Michael Brown. And also, you cite something that Daryl Gates, the former LA police chief, said.
I think that the example of Daryl Gates is quite interesting because he occupies this certain position, this certain status within the history of American policing. And he gave, he was at a presentation the day after the beating of Rodney King. If you remember, he was head of LAPD when Rodney King was beaten by several police officers. And we now know about that event because of a video that was taken of it. And so it's there for everyone to see. The day after that event, that video hadn't been released. And so his kind of PR problem wasn't there. And he was giving a talk at a major conference on policing with the National Criminal Justice Commission. And he basically said, well, you know, the problem is that we need to understand that, you know, police forces are fighting an enemy. And he's very categorical about using this language of the enemy. And he then even went one step further and said, well, and this makes a lot of people feel quite uncomfortable, right? And it makes people feel uncomfortable because one of the things that we discover when we realize that police forces are fighting an enemy is that the enemy is within. You know, the enemy is within, in his case, the American social body. So he was very honest and open about that. And I think we need to take these kind of arguments seriously, these claims seriously, because they're not meant metaphorically.
Yeah, and you write that in connection with the Ferguson protests, internal mission briefings produced by the Missouri National Guard reveal that the National Guard was expected to treat protesters as enemy forces. So this analysis pushes back on what you call and what is in fact certain features of liberal ideology, ways of thinking, mainstream ways of thinking about police and what they exist to do and what they exist to be. What are some of the features of this liberal ideology?
The starting point, I think, has to be to challenge the notion that policing exists to deal with crime. And so that's the key feature of liberal thinking about policing. and crime becomes a kind of a focus which detracts our attention away from what police power in general is intended to do. Right? And so what liberal ideology has done is it's constructed a whole kind of an agenda on of policing organized around the notion of crime, organized around the idea that police exist simply to enforce the law, and police has to exist because there are law breakers, and that's why policing is essential to our order. And I think one of the things we have to do, one of the things I'm trying to do in the article is to rebut that, is to say, actually, this is a kind of alibi for police power in general, right? It's an alibi because it plays on people's insecurities, it plays on people's assumptions about crime in general and about specific crimes in particular. And it detracts our analysis from what we need to be doing in terms of understanding police power. And that is a far more general analysis, which is to situate police forces within an argument about the liberal state in general. Right? What is the liberal state doing in general? What are police forces doing in the context of the liberal state? And what that is meant to point our attention to is the question of, you know, why does the liberal state exist in the first place? Why does police power exist in the first place? And that draws our attention to the relationship between policing, the police power, as I like to call it in general terms, and capitalism. You know, how is it that capitalism is created? How is it that capitalism is sustained on an ongoing basis?
His name is Mark Neocleus. Neocleous. He's professor of the Critique of Political Economy in the Department of Social and Political Sciences at Brunel University, London. And he is the author of many books, including A Critical Theory of Police Power, The Fabrication of the Social Order. We are talking about an article that he wrote that appears in a special issue of the journal Social Justice about police power. He edited that issue of the journal with the Anti-Security Collective. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Karl Marx wrote in the early 1840s that security, quote, is the highest social concept of civil society, the concept of police. In what ways is this significant?
Yeah, so good question. You know, when Marx says, you know, security is the highest concept of civil society, what he's referring to when he refers to civil society is what in the German term bürgerliche Gesellschaft can also be translated as bourgeois society, what we might now translate as capital, right? It's capitalism. And I think Marx is incredibly insightful. I think he's picking up on something that's going on in the liberal revolutions and the liberal constitutions that are created in the second part of the 18th century, the French and the American ones, obviously, which are the ones he talks about there, where he picks up on this theme of security that runs through these documents, which is the kind of hidden theme, right? We talk constantly about, you know, liberty. We talk constantly about equality, but actually Marx is pointing to the fact that these constitutional documents are really, really pushing home the point that the issue is security, that liberty, equality mean nothing without security. And he points to the idea that maybe it's security that is actually the supreme concept for civil society, for capitalist society. He's also aware, I think, that all of those liberal theorists of the Enlightenment, Adam Smith, Montesquieu, and so forth, all end up pointing not to liberty as the fundamental issue, but to security, right? Which is why all of those texts will often say, well, you know, liberty is fundamental, but on the other hand, sometimes liberty has to be given up in the name of security. And then what Marx does is something very cheeky. And he never really makes good on this, right? I think he basically, you know, gets interested in other arguments and doesn't really develop this argument. But he basically says, look, well, security is the supreme concept of capitalist society, of civil society. And he just, you know, it's, well, yeah, the concept of police. And I think he recognises that police and security are fundamentally conjoined, right, in a way that allows security to be the alibi for police powers, right? You have to accept these police powers because you want security. And it allows policing to be constantly refined, improved, intensified in the name of security. So I think it's a very polemical, very provocative claim that Marx makes. And that becomes the kind of starting point for my argument.
Marx analyzed capital. He theorized capital. And you referred earlier in this interview to capital and suggested that capital was a fundamental feature of society around which policing was, developed and operates. So what should we know for purposes of your analysis of police power about what Marx understood to be capital and how police were created or maintained in order to protect it?
So one of the things that Marx is trying to do when he talks about capital is to understand how capital is historically constituted. Right? How is capital made? Right? How did the bourgeois class, the rising bourgeois class, actually create capitalism? And within that question is a different way of formulating, which is how did the rising bourgeois class create a working class out of a feudal peasantry? Now, that's a big historical question, and there's lots of ways in which it can be addressed. What I want to do is to say, maybe we should be thinking about that historical creation of capitalism as a police project, right? A project of policing. In fact, maybe we should go further and say that historical creation is the police project par excellence. Right? In other words, that we should try and situate the rise of policing in the context of the rise of capitalism, and that these things go hand in hand, because what the rising bourgeois class needed to do was to create a working class, and the only way you could do this was through state power and the institutions of state power, which it understood as police institutions. So one of the things we can do, for example, is to think about the Vagrancy Acts, which, you know, pushed the masterless men that were thrown off from feudal serfdom, it pushed them into forms of wage labour, right? We can think about, for example, the enclosures movement, which pushes people off of common land into pursuing forms of wage labour. We can think about the enclosures movement as a police operation, right? Because if you can't find forms of subsistence outside of wage labour, then you're going to have to end up engaging in wage labour. And if you can enforce the enclosures movement through legislation, enforced by the police power, then in effect what you've got is a situation in which policing, in the most general sense of the term, is integral to the making of the working class. Right? And if policing is integral to the making of the working class, then in a sense what we're saying is, historically, the rise of capitalism could not have taken place without the police power. Right? The ruling class, in effect, used the state to police the working class into existence, to create the working class.
Yeah, and this issue of vagrancy laws and legislation, I think you're right that vagrancy laws are the ultimate form of police legislation. I think this relates to a claim you made earlier this hour, which is that police power is not about, or not primarily about, crime prevention or law enforcement. Does a person need to have committed some crime before being arrested under vagrancy law?
No, absolutely not. That's the beauty of vagrancy law. So one of the interesting things, of course, is that vagrancy law, as I said earlier, was integral to the creation of capitalism. But what's also interesting is that vagrancy law remains central to the way in which everyday policing takes place. And one of its beauties is that vagrancy law allows police on the street to intervene in situations, to stop people, to search people, to question people, without any kind of crime being committed, on the basis that the police officer in question suspects something, but they may simply suspect the person of having broken the vagrancy law. And if you look at vagrancy laws, they remain a remarkably, generous towards police discretion in terms of intervening in particular situations in the street, right? So you can be stopped in the UK under the Vagrancy Act of 1824, which is a part of which is still in place for British police forces. You can be stopped for, you know, really basic activities such as being suspected of begging, of moving in a particular way, of moving in a particular manner, of being in a particular part of the city in which you're not meant to be in. It basically gives police on the street a kind of carte blanche possibility of just intervening in situations which enable them to stop and question people and, of course, potentially arrest them. The other thing that vagrancy law does is it provides this kind of really expansive kind of discretionary power for police officers. And that is fundamental to the way policing takes place on the street, right? That what police officers want more than anything is the possibility, the right even, to just simply stop people and question them for whatever reason that the police officer might give at the time. And what vagrancy legislation does is it offers precisely that, right? So it is the kind of foundational form of police discretionary power. And it's, of course, police discretionary power on the street that creates so many of the problems that we basically witness day after day after day after day, where police officers stop someone and before you know it, they're carrying out acts of brutality or even killing.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Mark Neoklios joins me. He's a London-based critical theorist who focuses on questions of state power and capital, especially as they pertain to police, security, and war. His books include War Power, Police Power, The Universal Adversary, Security, Capital, and, quote, The Enemies of All Mankind, and A Critical Theory of Police Power, The Fabrication of the Social Order. Well, let's say we accept your argument, and of course people can read in your books much more detail than you can provide this hour, but let's say we accept your argument that police power, the functioning of police, was integral to the making of the working class, to the disciplining of workers, to keeping idle and otherwise idle and disorderly people in line so they could serve the needs of capital. Well, what about the argument that, and you write that it's a claim commonly made in police studies, that something happened, in the 19th century, such that the police became more professionalized, that they became increasingly focused on things like law enforcement and crime prevention, that functions that didn't relate to that were parceled out to other state entities, state agencies? What do you make of that claim?
That's a good question. One of the things that I've been trying to do, which I do in the article and I pursue at greater length elsewhere, is to is to argue that rather than talk about the police, we should be talking about police power, or even if you prefer, police powers. And I do that partly because I think we need a concept of police that isn't simply reducible to the police institution. And the reason for that is because what I want to argue is that we need to understand how it is that the state polices, in the broadest possible sense of the term, polices civil society. And by polices here, I mean not only kind of manages or controls, but actually constitutes and reconstitutes social order as a whole and political subjects. So I'm using the term police power in the broadest possible sense, right? And the idea is to try and integrate an account of the police institution, or if you like, police forces, within that broader concept of police power. Now, that's problematized by the kind of developments that you're pointing to in the 19th century, where various parts of what was historically the police power are kind of hived off into different parts of the state, right? So classically, you know, prior to the 19th century, police forces were charged with, you know, street lighting, bridge building, firefighting, and so forth, right? And these get separated out. Okay, now we could follow the liberal line and say these are not about policing anymore, right? Or on the other hand, we could try and integrate these processes, these systems, into a general theory of police power, which would enable us, I think, to connect them, to reconnect them back to the way police forces operate. So what I argue is that actually, you know, despite that kind of 19th century development in the professionalization of other forms of other parts of the state, the police connection with these things is never lost. All of these different systems operate through or with or in conjunction with police forces, right? They often find that they're key moments that they have to reintegrate police officers back into their processes in order to achieve the goals that they want to achieve. And the police forces themselves presuppose that they have a fundamental right and capability to involve themselves in these other activities, right? Which is why, of course, we find police forces here, there, and everywhere. The ubiquitous nature of policing has not been lost with the supposed professionalization of police forces in the 19th century.
Mark Neoklios joins us on Against the Grain. I'm C.S. Song. He is professor of the Critique of Political Economy at Brunel University, London. And Mark, your article about police power in this special issue of the journal Social Justice, your article is called Original, Absolute, Indefeasible, in quotes, or what we talk about when we talk about police power. Original, absolute, indefeasible. Where does that language come from? And what does that tell you, and what should it tell us about the nature of police power? Obviously, you've already referred to the kind of massive discretion that police officers have when accosting, let's say, someone they consider to fall within the ambit of vagrancy laws. But original, absolute, indefeasible suggests something maybe quite a bit more expansive.
Yes, that's exactly what that that terminology is meant to do. And that terminology, and I give several examples of similar phrases in the article, is it's taken from a variety of sources. One is just political philosophers through the 18th and 19th century who tried to get us to think about police and how we should understand police. And the other source is lawyers who have thought long and hard about police powers. And I guess there's a third source, which is a series of case laws in which, you know, senior lawyers have commented on the nature of policing. And the reason I want readers to go to these sources is because I think they're actually incredibly useful in focusing our attention on what it is that is going on when policing is taking place. This phrase you've picked up on one particular quote, which is, you know, the idea that it's original, absolute, and indefeasible. I you know, if you just take that for example, you know, it's original in the sense that, you know, no state can exist without some fundamental police powers in its own power, right? No state can exist without having the powers to police the thing that it's said to exist to police, right? Namely, civil society. And it's absolute, right? And this is really important, right? Because all of these political philosophers, all of these police lawyers, right? All of these case studies in the Supreme Courts and point us in the same direction, which is, you know something? We, whoever we are, right? We, political philosophers, police ideologists, lawyers, we find it very difficult to say what the limits on police power can or should be, right? That in some sense, there is something kind of integral to police power that makes it absolute. And however much we might want to try and delimit it, it's impossible to do. You know, that policing is, in some sense, an act of sovereignty, and that act of sovereignty cannot be delimited. I think we need to kind of take on board what they're saying. By that, I don't mean we should give up struggling against these powers, quite the opposite. I think recognizing what they're telling us is important for how we go about thinking about policing, and how we might then go about challenging some of these powers, because that's the problem, right? That's the problem, because any challenge to police powers finds itself up against precisely this very, very practical problem, which is that politicians and courts will often go, well, no, right? You can't challenge them in that way, right? No, what you think is an act of excessive or completely discriminatory violence is not so because it's conducted in the name of police.
Yeah, and what you are saying goes against the grain, if I may, of, as you said earlier, liberal ideology. So many assertions of liberal ideology, such as that police carry out law as made by the legislature. Clearly, you would disagree with that. In what ways do the police go far beyond what the legislature says? And I think you also make an argument about what the legislature does to legitimize police practice at times.
Yeah, so I think the problem with kind of mainstream approaches to policing, and, you know, that stem from a kind of inbuilt set of liberal assumptions about how the state operates, is that there's an assumption that police simply exist to carry out the law as defined or announced by the executive and passed by the state in general, right? The judiciary and so forth, right? In other words, all the police does is carry out the law. So whatever the law is, the police simply enforce the law, right? And we got this mainstream notion, this everyday notion that that's what the police do. But what we need to recognize is that law is changed time and again by police action, right? Police act in certain ways, and this presses against existing laws, and then eventually politicians come around, right? Judges come around. They come around, they adjust their thinking to, if you like, the police reality, right? So the police behave in certain ways, and they will constantly behave in certain ways until laws are changed. And sometimes that takes years and years and years, right? It's a kind of, if you like, a war of attrition between police institutions and other institutions of the state. And sometimes it's very, very direct. I mean, you know, there's currently a debate in the UK about a new Crime and Policing Act that's going through Parliament that is designed to give police, you know, even greater powers over various forms of operation, in particular the policing of demonstrations and protests, but also the policing of everyday life, for example, you know, whether people might, for example, be, you know, living in their cars. And it's quite clear now that this new legislation came about because the senior police officer for the Metropolitan Police in London, who is this in effect de facto the most senior police officer in the land, you know, convinced the Home Secretary to bring in this new legislation. Right, the documentation is fairly clear now that the police said, well, we need some new legislation here, and it seems to be going through. Right, so there are various ways in which this can happen, you know, through a general war of attrition over years and years of the police constantly doing something until the law is changed, or a straightforward, you know, word in the ear of the Home Secretary. But even if that doesn't happen, you know, the amount of times police engage in acts of what we would call illegality, right? But what police officers will say, you know, they have to do in order to carry out their everyday duties, in order to ensure that law is law and order are enforced. The research on this, the documentation on this is very clear now, right? That police engage in acts of illegality, you know, whether it's incredibly mundane acts of illegality or major acts of illegality, right down, of course, to the point of killing people. And they will justify these acts on the grounds that, you know, they're carrying out police duty, right? They're engaged in police operations. And this gives them a certain kind of immunity.
Yeah, in fact, you cite a study showing that most police, I'm not sure in what jurisdiction, most police officers believe that to fully impose and adhere to the rule of law would make police work impossible.
Yeah, and that goes back to the conversation we were having a little while ago, which is, you know, the police is, they don't, so this is tricky, right? In a sense, we need a kind of psychoanalytic reading of the whole police institution, which is impossible. But, you know, police don't really believe that what they're doing is enforcing the law. What they believe they're doing is maintaining order. But of course, they can't simply say that because we have the whole ideology of the rule of law. So what they have to do is to play the game that what they're doing is enforcing the law.
Democratic control of police. This is a demand, a fairly common demand, right? We need to restructure police institutions and departments so that there is input, there is some level of oversight from citizens, from regular folks, from non-police. What is that a way to counter, in your mind, the absolute power, the overweening discretion of police forces?
So it's quite hard to answer that question without getting into trouble, in the sense that the political impetus behind it, in terms of where I think you're coming from, is obviously something that in one sense I'm very sympathetic to. The problem is that there have been so many times in which this has been tried and either nothing happens or nothing changes, or what's worse is that the democratic control, or the supposed democratic control, often involves control by, you know, thoroughly reactionary, racist, conservative elements. So I think there's a practical problem, right, which is what exactly does this mean, this democratic control? I think there's a more kind of theoretical issue, if you like, a broader issue to take on board here, which is what we were saying just a few minutes ago about the idea of policing being absolute. There has to remain something absolute about policing for policing to continue in the way that it does. Right? Is if you like, it's precisely that absolutism, to use that term in a kind of modern sense, not in the 18th century absolutist state sense, it's that absolutism of policing, right, that completely unchallengeable nature of policing, that makes it entirely resistant to the kind of democratic control that I think a lot of activists want. They want that. There's something not just original, absolute, indefeasible about police power. There's something kind of slippery about it, right? There's something gelatinous about it, right? That, you know, is going to constantly keep slipping out of our hands, right? And that there's something about the police power that is it's designed in that way. It's designed in a way that means that the people, the citizens, will never be able to fundamentally, you know, democratically control it, because it's got its nature as a substance puts it outside of democratic control, puts it outside of democratic management.
Mark Neoklios, critical theorist and author based at Brunel University London, is my guest on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. So, you're giving us a very stark, sobering picture of police and police power. Clearly, the suggestion is that you do not approve of this institution, or whatever you want to call it, having this amount of power over our lives. And, of course, its agenda with respect to the working class is something you strongly object to. So the question arises, what should we do with the police? What's the solution? We may be speaking in a realm of speculation and to some extent fantasy, given the power that police has, given the power of the state, given the relationship between police and sovereignty. But in an ideal world, what would happen to the police?
Well, okay, so that's a good question. I mean, look, on the one hand, right, the arguments that I'm making are designed to stress the relationship between policing and capitalism. And they're designed to say, look, actually, the issue here is capitalism. The issue we have is we live in a world of exploitation, of expropriation, of alienation, and such a world needs policing because it cannot exist without the police power, right? And so long as you have, you know, a world in which, you know, resources and lives and labor and work is expropriated from the people and the people are exploited, we're not going to get rid of the police power, right? Now, I realize, of course, that is not going to be a satisfactory answer to a lot of people, right? Because it's essentially a way of saying, well, if you want to do it, if you want to really solve the problems of policing, you need to abolish capital, which is my position, right? But I realize, you know, we live in this world and we feel like we want to make a difference in this world, and my answer won't be satisfactory. But I think we still need to actually make that argument time and again, right? Because we need to recognize this is the conditions of our existence, right? And that is what we are facing. That said, we are living in an incredibly exciting moment in which there are all sorts of movements and challenges that are taking place, which are, you know, incredibly exciting, and it will be really interesting to see how they pan out. Let me make an observation which tries to pick up on the two directions in which this answer is going. On the one hand, the direction of the abstract theory, which points to our fundamental problem, and on the other hand, a kind of, you know, a sense in which there is an excitement in this moment. So in June, two things happened, one in the US and one in the UK, which I think are quite interesting. The first thing that happened was that Officer Chauvin was found guilty of the murder of George Floyd in the US, yeah, whatever it was, the second degree murder, or I forget the exact distinctions that you have there, but nonetheless, he was found guilty. In the same month, a British police officer was found guilty of the manslaughter, but not the murder, of someone called Dalian Atkinson. I'm mentioning his name because he happens to be an ex-professional footballer, so it was a widely publicised case. I'm assuming your listeners will know lots of detail about the George Floyd murder, so I won't go into detail there. But just so, in case people don't know, the officer in the UK, PC Monk, was called out to an incident in the street where Atkinson appeared to have been engaged in some kind of episode in which he was having some kind of breakdown. I hesitate about using some of these words, but you know, it's some kind of psychotic episode. Anyway, there was an issue, right? And PC Monk pulled out his taser and fired it for 33 seconds, which is 6 times longer than the regulations allow. But then, after using the taser, then kicked Dalian Atkinson in the head twice, and Atkinson died. So a few years later, this case came to court, and in June, PC Monk was found guilty of Atkinson's manslaughter. Now, I think it's quite interesting, right? Both of these cases came about in the same month, and I think it's interesting because if one was being optimistic, and I say if, right, because I'm not an optimist, as you can probably gather from most of the things I've said, but if one was being optimistic, one would say these two cases together could be construed as taking major steps into challenging a whole logic of police immunity, right? And I know that the US talks about qualified immunity, but deep down, of course, that qualified immunity is not really qualified in many significant ways, right? But there's a whole logic of police immunity which has allowed police on the street to get away with acts of violence and killing, okay? And time and again, no police officer is found guilty of either manslaughter or murder. And I think in the article that you've read, I think I give the details from the UK that, you know, in some 30-odd years from 1990, there were just short of 2,000 people that died in the hands of police, right? Whether in police custody or on the street being handled by police. And not one officer, up until June, not one officer has been found guilty of manslaughter or murder. And then suddenly, PC Monk is found guilty of manslaughter in the very same month that Chauvin is found guilty of the murder of George Floyd. Now, these two cases, right, and it's only two cases, seem to me to be potentially, at least, a significant inroad into the whole logic of police immunity, where police can carry out acts of violence and get away with it, right? Be immune from prosecution for the acts of violence carried out in the name of their uniform or in the name of the state. So, I think there's something there, right? I think there's something interesting going on. Right, that maybe some of the campaigns around police violence are having an impact. Maybe. I don't know for sure, right? I'm slightly hesitant that in the case of PC Monk, if it wasn't for the kicking in the head and it was just the use of the taser that killed him, he would have got away with it, right? But nonetheless, right, there's something possibly interesting going on. But, sorry, that was, if you like, the optimistic side of my answer. But that whole concept of immunity is far more powerful than we realize, right? And that whole concept of immunity stems from a state logic that goes back over a century, right? Which allows the state to grant certain personnel immunity from prosecution for acts carried out in the name of the state. So the classic case of immunity, of course, is diplomatic immunity. Or if you like, the immunity of ambassadors when they go and situate themselves in another sovereign territory. But that's that same logic of immunity that has been attached to, for example, soldiers out in the field, but also, of course, police officers, right, as agents of the state. Right. So on the one hand, I'm kind of going, well, I'm thinking maybe something interesting is happening here. Maybe finally something has happened to chip away, to cut into that notion that police officers should always be immune from prosecution for their acts of violence. On the other hand, and this goes back to my more general kind of my insistence on a more general theory of police power, I think to really understand where that immunity comes from, we have to understand the police officer on the street as an agent of the state, right? That the sovereign state recognizes as its agent of violence on the street, and that will, and that has for centuries attached to the officer an immunity which it's going to take a real, real struggle to undermine, to, for us to challenge.
Mark Neoclios, I'll spell that again, Neoclios, professor of the Critique of Political Economy in the Department of Social and Political Sciences at Brunel University, London. You may want to check out his books, which include A Critical Theory of Police Power, The Fabrication of the Social Order, recently out from Verso, War Power, Police Power, and Critique of Security. We've been talking about his general body of work, some of which has been condensed into an article he wrote that appears in a special issue of the journal Social Justice that he co-edited with the Anti-Security Collective. The issue is entitled A Critical Theory of Police Power in the 21st Century, and Mark's article is entitled Original, Absolute, Indefeasible, or What We Talk About When We Talk About Police Power. Mark, thank you so much for your work, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for your time and interest.
And that program first aired on August 23rd of this year. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.